You know, those first three steps that I talked about last night as I went through them were not all that difficult to experience. And I, of course, made the usual objections that new people do because these were strange ideas to me and a sort of elusive. I think when you're first here, it's a little elusive because Alcoholics Anonymous is that way. I was used to, after 19 years in the Catholic school system, I was used to dogma and rules and things like that where everything was very definite and very certain. But it seems here that things were not that way. They were very elastic, and you sort of fashioned your own way. There were these guidelines that were very wide. The parameters were very wide, and Alcoholics Anonymous has this ability to adjust itself to no matter what. We're like a great big self-cleaning oven, and the stuff keeps coming in, and the oven just cleans itself out, and you know, nobody ever seemed to be in charge of anything, and nobody ever wondered how, you know, I was looking, you know, like, who's in charge here? And people would just leave, you know, nobody wanted to be in charge. It was very different than anything I had experienced. But no matter what the newness of it or the difference of it was, the fact of the matter was that it worked. I mean, it worked for me, and that's all I was interested in. I mean, I have your best interest at heart, but really, when you come right down to it, I'm still interested in maintaining my own sobriety. And that's what I was interested in then. I thought, mistakenly at the time, that if I could just get the drinking settled, then I could go on about my business of being a master of the universe. But first, I had to get, you know, just put that drinking behind me, and then I would be able to do these things. Well, as you know, it just doesn't seem to work out that way. And so the first three steps, they did bring me to a point where I did not drink. And I did not want to drink. And I was comfortable in the idea that here was a place where I could come and live a life, whatever life it was to be. I had no idea. Without drinking. And that was good enough for me. And then I equate the first three steps, I equate that to an emergency room in the hospital. Because when I got here, in my own mind, it was an emergency. I mean, I was in real trouble. I felt like I was being fragmented. I was going to fly apart at any minute. And just, I don't know what was going to happen next. It was just, I could not handle it. It was terror. Absolute terror. And I told you last night, I don't think it was drinking. It was just, it wasn't what I was drinking that was doing this. It was what I was thinking that was doing it. It was doom. Everywhere I turned was open pits and just terrible. But you know, that wonderful healing power of the program just settled. And the emergency passed. And the fact that is, that emergency rooms and hospitals are for that. They are to handle emergencies. They're not there for the cure of disease, really. It's to handle emergencies. It's to make sure the blood pressure is right, the fluids are right, the wounds are sewed up and bound up, the lacerations are taken care of, the bones are set, the bullets are taken out, the bandages are put on. That's what an emergency room is for. It's an emergency. Then they take you up to the 7th floor of the hospital, where they kill you at leisure. Because when you get up to the 7th floor, that's when the business of medicine begins, with all of the tests and the diagnosis and the prognosis and the prescription of medicines and the protocol of care for the disease and all of that stuff. That takes place up there when the emergency is all over. And I had come to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time. As I told you, I lasted 10 months. Got drunk, not for any particular reason, and I don't know whether I planned to get drunk or I don't know any of that. So I was at a place, and the guy said, have a drink, and I said, certainly, and I grabbed it, and I drank it. And then I went through 2 years of absolute hell. So now I'm back here the second time, and I'm in almost the same time frame. I'm within the first year toward the end of it, and I begin to exhibit signs of alcoholism, symptoms of alcoholism. Dr. Silkworth, in our book, in the doctor's opinion, writes, based on his knowledge of alcoholism, which was considerable, he writes of the alcoholic who is not drinking. Silkworth's opinion has to do with an alcoholic who's not drinking, as Silkworth observed him to be. And Silkworth said these people, when they're not drinking, are nervous, irritable, and discontented. Until, he said, they can once again experience that elusive feeling that comes immediately after a few drinks. Drinks which they see other people taking with impunity. And he's describing an alcoholic who doesn't drink, who's dry, but not yet sober. And here I am in my period of time for the second time, and I am exhibiting those symptoms. I am nervous, I am irritable, and I am discontented. The meetings are boring. There's too much smoke in the room. I'm contributing to most of it. There's no parking. I mean, wouldn't you think they have parking, for Christ's sake? Well, we really help this church. They don't even go, for Christ's sake, why don't they have the... You know, the speakers are very boring. I had a great suspicion many of them had never gone to college. You know? But where do they get these people? And, you know, and he's watching me. And one day he said to me, here's the story. He said, you are very close to getting drunk. Because you are an untreated alcoholic. And it's true. And my own thought, which I learned from somewhere along the line, I think this is true because I've seen it to be true. When anyone comes here with the only requirement for membership, I was given a great spiritual influx of power. But that is not for an unlimited period of time. You get that, and we call it the pink cloud, you get that great surge, you know, around the second step when you see there's hope. Maybe this thing can be handled. And that power comes in, but it only goes certain period of time, and then it begins to wane, and then I begin to exhibit nervousness, irritability, and discontent. And the book says, when you turn the page, when you're all finished with the third step prayer and an indication that perhaps you should take it with someone else and say it with someone else in the program, something I didn't mention last time, you turn the next page and it says, now we get down to causes and conditions. Now we're out of the emergency room and we're up on the seventh floor where we can establish causes and conditions. You see, I understood, and my sponsor explained it to me. Here I am, I haven't had a drink in maybe 10 or 11 months, and I'm acting this way. And he said to me, look, obviously, it's not the drinking that's doing this to you because you don't have any alcohol in your system. You're not drinking, but you're acting like a lunatic. There is something else the matter. It is not the drinking. There is something else wrong with you. And now is the time for you to find that out. Now, nobody seems to know the cause of alcoholism. The medical profession and the health care industry issue these communiques from time to time. And there's great talk about endorphins and THIQs and acetates and neural transmitters. And it's wonderful, wonderful talk. But when you get right to it and you ask them what causes alcoholism, they don't know. They just don't know. And you say things like I do, and for 8 years, I lectured at a medical school. on this subject. These idiots are going through medical school. They got 2 hours in pharmacology and they got 2 hours for me. Well, yeah. But I would go to the medical school and there they are in their white coats. And I mean, I don't have any disrespect for the medical profession. And there they were, three of them in the white coats. And I would say to them, listen, is this genetic? You know, because I've met so many alcoholics, mothers, fathers. And they said, we have no evidence that it is. So I'd open up to the class by saying, I am talking to you about a genetic disease. And they get all upset. What the hell do I care? I'm telling them. I've been at thousands of meetings. I heard it over and over again. My mother, my father, my mother, my father. But the bottom line really is the truth of matters, they just don't know. And they'll tell you that if you really pin them down. They don't know. It could be this. It could be that. At least it runs in families. They have a whole thing about science that I don't understand. Don't want to understand. Alcoholics Anonymous is a very, very simple thing. It says in the book and it says in the 12 and 12. It says that defects of character were the primary cause of our alcoholism and at our failure at life. Failure at life. Defects of character. And the fourth step is the medicine. This is the beginning of a process that runs from the fourth step through the tenth step. The inventory process, and this is the medicine for the disease of alcoholism. The emergency is all over. I'm not drinking, I don't want to drink, and I think I'm going to be all right here. It's time to take the medicine. I came the first time, I did not take the medicine. I did not do a fourth step. And I got drunk. Because I didn't have a group, I didn't have a sponsor, and I didn't take a fourth step. If I had been a member of a group and had a sponsor, somebody would have made me do a fourth step. But I didn't have that first time. So I was just an untreated alcoholic, rattling around with no medicine. Now he said, take the medicine. Take it. Medicine's no fun. I mean, we all know that. There's no fun involved in medicine, but we have a different attitude about medicine. You go to a physician for something, and he gives you a big bottle of this brown, noxious shit, and he says, drink it. So you do. You know, alcoholics, he says, take 1 teaspoon every 4 hours, so you take 7 teaspoons every 15 minutes, and you're going to get better twice as fast, because, you know, more than he does. But we do it without question. Nobody, you know, nobody says what's in the bottle, who is this penicillin, where did the mold come from, who did it, what was the name of the doctor, where's the laboratory, I want to investigate all of this. They say, put it in your mouth, you take it. The guy, you go to the doctor, you say this and that. He says, here, you see this? Stick it in your ass twice a day. Well, he says, yeah, how far up, doctor? No problem. We follow those instructions. But an alcoholic, you say to him, now listen, Charlie, I want you to write down on a piece of paper. Oh, no. Listen, I'm working on that. 50% of Alcoholics Anonymous is working on the fourth step at all times. You know, you go to the first step and they all tell you about how they drank. They think that it says, tell us how you drank. Like they drank a little differently than you did, you know. The second step, they think it says, tell us how crazy you were. So they tell you stupid things about drunken driving, like, you know, like that's being crazy. That's not being crazy. And the third step, oh boy, that's when we're in tune with God. They're hand in hand with the master of the universe, you know, and they're rattling around. But then you get to the fourth step. You're next. I'm working on that. Or we have other varieties who do a fourth step about every 20 minutes. Well, I've done the first one, but I'm going to do another one because I'm not sure about the first one. And then I'll do the third one, and then, you know. The step is very simple. It says make A. Don't misunderstand me. If you want to make an inventory of 20 minutes, it's okay with me. I'm telling you what the step says, the English language. Make a searching and fearless moral inventory. Singular. This is the medicine. And we all know if you don't take the medicine, you're not going to recover from the disease. Imagine some guy comes into the physician with the flu and he's hacking and coughing and sneezing and all of the rest of it. And he gives him the bottle of the brown noxious crap. And the guy's back a month later, and he's worse. The first thing the doctor says is to him is, did you take the medicine? And the guy says, no. Well, why did you take the medicine? Well, I don't want to take it. Well, you're not going any better. Well, get me better. You're a doctor, for Christ's sake. I'm a sick man. I need help here. I'll take the medicine. I don't want to take the medicine. Stick it up your ass. Why does a physician say, oh, yeah, Charlie, goodbye? Because if you don't take the medicine, you're going to get the illness. It's such a simple thing. And here's the medicine. The medicine is this. Now, it's in the English language. It says an inventory. Lately, since I'm an old AA fart, I can complain about things and be grouchy. And lately, with the advent of so-called treatment centers, which is misnamed because there's no treatment for this disease, they're mostly rip-off centers. I know one that's got 9 holes of golf. That's like a resort center. I know another one where you get laid a lot, and that's sort of a pleasure center. But as long as the insurance companies are sitting still for this, I have no brief for the insurance companies if this is the way they want to spend their money. But they don't do much good for alcoholics. In fact, I think they do harm to them. And here's what happens. You sit here, the old person like me, and in through the door comes this guy, lugging with him this suitcase. And he's got 28 days under his belt, and he's been in Happy Dale. And he said, I want you to look at this. I said, what do you got in there? He said, I have my autobiography. It's a 3,000-page document. And they made me write it in Burning Acres, or I couldn't get out. So here it is. Now, what could be worse than asking a certified egomaniac to write his autobiography? Can you imagine anything worse than this? Now, the step says inventory. And these are not big words. Dr. Bob went to Dartmouth, and he went to medical school, so we can make an assumption that he knew something of the English language. Bill was a graduate of law school, so we're absolutely certain about him. An inventory, as the book says, a business that doesn't take an inventory goes broke. An inventory, if you have a simple operation like a shoe store, an inventory is what you have on the shelf now that you can convert into money now. Now what you had on the shelf when you opened it up 50 years ago or 30 years ago, that's not going to do you any good doing an inventory, you know. And this autobiography, the first 2,500 of the 3,000 pages is devoted to the failure of his parents to love him. So he goes to adult children of alcoholics and finds out he's a victim. And none of this is his fault in the first place because his parents are incapable of love and awe. That's great to have somebody else he can beat up on, see? He can go to the grave and dig them up and tell them what a terrible job they did and how they ruined his life before it even started. And then you read this crap and he's talking about he's in the fourth grade and nobody likes him. I know why nobody liked him in the fourth grade. A little alcoholic, that's why. Little egomaniac. Arrogant, no good, little son of a bitch in the fourth grade. Everybody knew it. He was defective then. And it is funny, except that people get drunk if they don't do this, and then they die. And the book is very, very clear. It's so simple in this book. First of all, it says, write a list of the people you hate. And they give, of course, they knew educated people like us were coming along. They give you a form. Just like practicing law, you fill in the form. There it is, you know? It's like a deed. They give you a form. Remember Mr. Brown? I told my wife about my girlfriend. What's my job? By any civilized standard of conduct, we are dealing here with a world-class prick. But it says if I am mad at Brown, if I hate Brown, something matter with me. It's absolute communism. But there it is. And you know, people come up to me and they come up to you too when you sponsor people and they say, I'm having trouble with the fourth step. What kind of shit is that? I tell him, listen, you want me to tell you who you hate? And the hell, I don't know who you hate. You hate who you hate. You know that right in the front of you every night you go to sleep. Oh, one of these days I'm going to get this bastard. You know, you got a whole list. And you know why you hate him. And the book says, put down what it threatens. Job, security, sexual relationships. And in the last page over there, the edge of the page, you notice in parentheses, fear. Permeates our whole being as alcoholics. Fear of this, fear of that. It's devastating. That's what it was for me. Terror, fear. Every day was doom. My hair would stand up. Here it comes. This is the day they come for me, boy. Bang, bang on the door. Are you okay? Yeah. Bing. You have a right to remain silent. And no wonder when you turn the page in the book, it says we listed our fears, even though no resentment was attached to them. Simplest thing in the world. You don't need any help from me to tell you. I can't tell you what you're afraid of. I can tell you what I was afraid of. And then you turn the page, it's just simply a question of reading the manual, reading the instructions. Because we're too smart for that, alcoholics. You know, they get instructions. First thing, they throw the instructions away. All right, I'll put this together. Everything's all right. It says, list your fears. Just list them. That's all. Even though no resentment is attached. Then you turn the page and it says, we listed our faults. Our faults. And in that, I asked him about that. He said, go to 12 and 12. They have a list there of the most common mistakes or errors of judgment. They call them sins. Sin is not a word I use much. It's just the most common errors that we all make. And with no surprise, especially in my case, pride leads the list. Pride, envy, gluttony, sloth, lust. I thought they said rust. I was all set for that. And all you have to do is, you know, how it affects your life. It's a list. Bing, bing, bing. Then you turn the next page. And it says, now about sex. That's what it says. Now about sex. It doesn't say now about love. It doesn't say now about marriage. It doesn't say now about deep and meaningful relationships. It says now about sex. And it goes on to say that many of us, if not most of us, have some type of a sexual problem. It says some people in Alcoholics Anonymous say we should have no sex. Others, it says, would put us on a straight pepper diet. Some would have no seasoning for our fares. We think there's a middle way, and it tells us. It's a little sex manual for two pages. That's very nice. And it says you write that down. And at the bottom of that, it says God alone. God alone can judge your sex situation. Saves everybody a lot of trouble. All you perverts. God alone. And then you're finished. Then it's finished. It's finished. That's the inventory. It's four lists. Nothing to it. And it embarrasses me to tell you. It took me 3 years and 45 minutes to do it. 3 years and 45 minutes. You see, when people say they have a four-step problem, and you hear it a lot when you sponsor people, don't you? Well, they get sort of hung up on the four-step. And so I'm having a four-step problem. That isn't true. It's not a four-step problem. The reason they don't want to make a searching and fearless moral inventory is because they really never have decided to turn their will and their lives over to the care of God as they understand them. The reason they have never made that crucial decision is they have not yet come to believe that there is a power greater than their own that can restore them to sanity. And the reason that they have not yet come to believe that there's such a power is they really have never conceded to themselves, to their innermost selves, that they are powerless over alcohol. It's not a fourth-step problem. It's a first-step problem. It's a first step problem. If that first step, which is the only one we can take 100%, if that first step, if there's any type of reservation there, then obviously you don't need a power greater than your own because you've retained power. So why make a decision? Because it's all fruitless anyhow. So why do the inventory or take your medicine? So you get sick. So don't let anybody kid you about a four-step problem. It's a first-step problem. I was given the deadline. You do it or get out of here. And I guess in that, go back to the medical analogy, most of us needed somebody to make us take the medicine. Huh? Your mother give you a little sugar. Take the medicine. A little honey or something. Nobody likes to take medicine. But without the medicine, it's a very simple matter to me, without the medicine, all you're going to have is untreated alcoholism. Can I get a cup of coffee?
Yes.
And so here I am with this fourth step. I have it. I showed it to him. I brought it to him. I didn't show it to him. I brought it to him. I said, I've done it. And he was, very nice about that. And I said, I want to go over with you because I've heard that. You go over with your sponsor. That's the way you do it. And he said to me, have you admitted it to God? I said, no. He said, well, you got to do that first. Because it says, admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another. First, you have to admit it to God. I felt a little foolish, I'm sitting there with this piece of paper, which I did sort of against my better judgment, just to satisfy this fanatic I was dealing with. So he wouldn't be going like, he used to go like this all the time, Paul. I didn't want that, I felt foolish. What am I supposed to do now? He said, I'll leave you alone. You admit it to God. And now I'm sitting there, and I don't know what I said to God. I don't know. I mean, I don't even know if I knew what... how you go about this. It seems... But I did have this notion I talked about last night about a powerful father. So I told him, I said, listen, this is what I got here. It's all on this paper. And this is it. It's the best I could do. And this is what I think is the matter with me. And I don't know. Now, what do you say to God under these circumstances? And recently, when I think of this process, I have been also thinking about my favorite story in the Bible. It's an excellent story. You all know the story. But I'm going to tell it to you anyhow. It's in the Gospel of Luke. It's a story of the mercy of God. And the story concerns this wealthy man who had the two sons. And the younger son came to him one day and said, I'd like my inheritance now. Remember this? And the father tried to talk him out of it. But the kid insisted. So against his better judgment, the father gave him the money. And the story and the Bible says he went off into a far land and he experienced women and wine and riotous living and song. But in a short time, of course, the money was gone. And when the money was gone, it's a given that the women were gone. And the wine was no longer flowing. And so he found himself, as you recall, living with pigs on a farm. He was living with the pigs and eating the same food as the pigs. And this is no place for a boy from a nice Jewish home to find himself. And so he thought to himself, I will go back to my father. Because even in my father's home, even the servants live better than this. And I will go back to my father and I will ask him if I can be a servant and just work for him. I don't want to be a son. I gave that up. But maybe he'll just give me a job. And so he started this journey back to his father. And the servants came to the father and they said, your son is coming back. And the Bible said the father went out to meet him met him halfway. And the Bible says he recognized him afar off. And when the son came, the father embraced him. And he said to the servants, bring out the good clothing and bring out the jewelry and bring out the anointing perfume and clothe my son and put the jewels on him and start a party for him and bring out the food and the fatted calf. And he said to his servants, this is my son. This is my son who was dead. And now he lives. This is my son who was lost. Now he's found. And they began that party. And the other son had stayed all the time, the older. And he was out in the fields working. And when he came back, he saw this party going on. He said to his father, what is this? The servants asked him to the party. He said, I'm not going. The father came out to see him. He said, come on to the party. He said, I won't go. He said, I've been here all these years working for you. Never once did you throw a party like this for me. And he goes away and comes back and look at this. Never once did I have clothing like that to wear. Never once did I have the jewelry. Never. And the father said to the son, the older son, you are my son. And everything I have is yours, because he's already given the younger one his portion. So he said, all this is going to be yours. But this is also my son, who was lost, and now he is found. This is my son who was dead, and now he lives. Join the party. And the older son went to the party. And that's the feeling that I'd like to experience, you know. I mean, I tell myself this is the way it was. When I said to my father, here I am. I've done some stupid things. I've been away. Now I'm back. And he started the party. It's been going on for a long time. And then, of course, I had to admit it to myself, and if you're like me, I spent a long time bullshitting myself, you know. It wasn't the booze. It wasn't me. It was those bastards. It was those cretins. I was surrounded by assassins and assholes, and no one had my vision, and no one understood, and, you know, and they're all jealous of my talents, and that rotten son of a bitch, dean of a law school, firing me, goddamn. I'll get him, that rotten bastard. Yeah, and I was kidding myself, lying to myself for years. It wasn't me and it wasn't the booze. Two lies. It was me and it was the booze. And then I went over with him and he was very understanding and he didn't give me much advice or anything. He was a funny guy. He really was. I would say something to him. He'd say, that's good. That's nice. That's good. Then I'd say, listen, my law firm just dissolved. We lost the best client. It's dissolved. I'm out of a job. Well, that's good. That's fine. He'd say, you don't have to worry about that anymore, you know. You want to get along too well with those guys. Well, it's all right, you know. I'd say, well, all that money I expected, that fee, that never came. Yeah, well, that's good. That's fine. You don't have to worry about that. You can go to more meetings, you know. When I was all finished, he said, you know, you're just sort of an alcoholic. This offended me. I had a sort of thought I was a rake, you know, something of a man of the world. After all, I had been in 5,000 bars and I got laid 3 times. Well, that third one was that close. He said, this is just typical alcoholic behavior. And you sort of garden variety. You know, I really didn't like that. I wanted to be the worst alcoholic that ever lived or the best alcoholic that ever lived or something like that. And he sort of went poo, poo, poo. Yeah. And things I've been carrying around in my head for years, Whoa. You know, I had a lot of secrets. Oh, I was a man of mystery. Very mysterious. Nobody knew where I was, you know. Great man of mystery. You could bring a guy here from Mars and say, see that one over there? And the guy would say, oh, yeah, he's a drunk. I was very mysterious, you know. I had all these secrets. Everything I did was a secret. And every night I'd try to go to sleep, I'd have to review my secrets to make sure they were still secret so I could sleep. Then I'd wake up in the morning and I'd go through my secrets and they were still all right. Then I'd take that train in, and while I was on the train, I'd have yesterday's secrets that I would have to add. Hope they never find out about that. You know? A lot of secrets. And now he tells me I'm just sort of ordinary alcoholic. And plus, he knew all my secrets. I tell you this, I think that the difference between my being dry and my being sober was this stuff. This opened up for me. I really got a firm glimpse at this stuff. What I think this program is about, to search, as I said last night, search for my understanding of a relationship with God. You notice this is the step where we call him by his maiden name. It's no more power greater than our own, no more God as you understand him. This is just plain old God. They just slip it right in and admit it to God, it says. It doesn't say higher power, greater power, God as you understand him. Just plain old God. They got you now, see. And they open it up, say, look. And then I don't think it's an accident that it's listed that way. God, ourselves, another human being. After all, what else is this? I mean, what is that? The term now that has lost its original meaning, relationships, you know. The only ones that seem to me to be important are these, God, myself, and another human being. What else? I don't have a relationship with tables, chairs, or automobiles. And what I learned in this is the importance, the priorities. God is first. I'm next. The other human beings come later. And in my life, since I've been sober and before, but I'm able to see it now. Everything is moving. You understand? People come into my life over here. And then they move through my life. And they come out over here. And while they're here, they're very important. But then they seem to have a function and a relationship with me. We function together. And they go out of my life. In 1984... I was invited to be a teacher in a brand new law school in Florida. And so I picked up and I went. And I had been in New York. I was born there. And I'd been there all my life except for the service. And I knew all kinds of people and I was successful and everything else. And everything I had up there, I thought at the time was very important to me, you know. I was a senior partner in a very good law firm. I thought that was important. I had a nice home. That was important. I had 7 children. That's important. I had an AA group that I've been a member of for 20 years. I thought that was important. And on August the 1st of 1984, that all changed. Just like that. I got an airplane, and now I'm down in Florida. And I have a whole new job, full-time teacher. I'm back. As a full-time teacher, I hadn't been a full-time teacher since 1963. I had been part-time, but now it's not full-time. I have a new AA environment to go to. New friends. New house. New everything. Everything that I thought was important just sort of became unimportant. It wasn't as though I didn't remember all of that back there and treasure it and all of that, sure. But it had gone out of my life. It just changed. And this is true almost on a monthly or annual basis. People come into my life, and they're in my life. You know, friends come in, and they pass through. And I don't see them anymore. The people I knew in New York for all those years, I don't see them anymore. It's very rare when I see them. But they were important while they were there. lovers come into your life, and they come through, and they're very important while they're there, but they go out again. The only thing that seemed to stay the same in my life was that I was attending AA meetings on a regular basis. Everything else was in a state of flux. I once lived in a house with 7 children. I now live in a house with no children. They visit from time to time, or I visit them from time to time, and we recently had a wedding, and I saw them all at once. And they're important to me, I guess, but I just don't see them anymore. They're not an active part of my life. They have their own lives. They're married, I have grandchildren, they have careers. All of my children are very, very successful. And they go about their business. And I'm no longer a really active part of their life. And that's part of the system. And they went through. But the important thing stays the same. God, myself, and this program. That has not changed. And I learned that. I got a glimpse of that in this step. That there would be this ongoing flux of life is all it is. You know, people get married, people get divorced, people are born, people die. And the permanency is this. And there was a difference between my being dry and being sober, because now in this step, the medicine began to work. The medicine was working. And we all know that feeling when you've been sick and down and all the rest of it. When you finally, your system has the medicine well enough into it that you begin to say, oh God, I'm going to get better. I'm not going to die. Huh? But bottom line is you have to take the medicine. In the last 8 years, I've had a lot of trouble with my eyes. I've had 6 surgical procedures on my eyes, 3 on each side. And they're very, very difficult, most of them. And I didn't want to, you know, the guy, this ophthalmologist, told me what I had, and he said, now tomorrow morning, 7 o'clock, we'll go to the operating room, and you'll be under a general anesthesia for about 5 hours, and I'll stick a knife in your eye, and I'll fix it. And that's what he did. It was no fun. No fun. But I could see. I could see. I don't see very well, but I could see. 25 years ago, I would not have been able. I would have been blind. But now, it's very high-tech eye medicine, especially. It was no fun to do that. It was no fun to be in a hospital for a week. It was no fun to be out of work for a month. No fun at all. But that was the means to get the result. And maybe this inventory is not much fun, and maybe bearing ourselves to someone else is not much fun, but it's the medicine. Medicine. So I came to a place where I had done what I was instructed to do, and I could feel a relationship. The book is very clear on this. I don't like people to read to me, but you're going to have to put up with it. Listen to what it says. Talking of this fifth step. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. You know, we talk about the promises in the book on page 83 and 84. These promises are all over our book. All over. And these promises here are promises that come after the fifth step. And I experienced those. I really did. I could be alone at perfect peace and ease. And at that stage of this development, I did have that feeling that the drink problem had disappeared. See, I had great doubt when I came back the second time as to whether or not I would make this program. After all, I didn't make it the first time. I was concerned I wouldn't make it the second time, and I knew if I didn't make it the second time, I probably would die. Because that's what everybody else in my family did. But at this stage, when I was finished with this, with him, I thought to myself, I can do this. You know? I got some hope at the second step, and around the fifth step, I really thought, I can do it. You know? I can do this. After all, I saw other people doing this. I thought to myself, this is going to be all right. I didn't know what was going to happen. And I still don't in my life. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know. Perhaps when we come here, they should do that to us, huh? Give us a little chart, a little map. You know, the first 3 years will be a little tough, and then the fifth year, things will begin to swing around, and in your 10th year, you'll be terrific, and then you go by your 25th year, you're absolutely fucking wonderful, and then you go to Oregon, and you talk to people in a room, you know. But we don't get that kind of a thing. We're told we just do it a day at a time, and then see what happens. And all you have to do is speak to anybody who's got time in here, and I'm such a person. I'm just telling you, everything is just great. And some days it's peachy keen. And so, and this is where I was, and I got to the sixth step. And the sixth step is, of course, the exact middle of this program. The whole program is going to turn on this step. And the words of the step are sort of, it's really a vestige. When AA first started, we didn't have steps and we didn't have a book, but they used the Oxford Group's four absolutes. Remember, they were absolutely honest and absolutely pure and absolutely unselfish and absolutely something. And then when the book was published, this idea of absolute, the group conscience said, this won't work for alcoholics. They're not absolutely anything except dry. So at least I was saved from absolute purity, which made some interesting moments over the 25 years that I've been here. How many times a week would semi-annually be? I forget. That's a little attempted humor there, you know. So here I am at right at the middle. And the words, like the words of all of our steps, are simplicity itself. He said to me, you're entirely ready to have God remove all your defects of character. I said, I am. He said, that's right. So what am I supposed to do? He said, nothing. Nothing to do. This is a bonus. This is what you get. If you do 1 through 5, you get 6. See, the step doesn't say they believed they were ready, they tried to be ready, they decided to be ready, they got themselves ready. It doesn't say a thing about it. It says, at the end of the first step, they were entirely ready. Now, the words threw me off a little because I suppose of law school training, you know, entirely and all and all. I said, what am I supposed to do? He said, not a thing. Read the book. So I took the book, and he pointed out to me, he says, after the fifth step, we take this book. See this one, the blue one, the big one, not the green one, not the red one. Not some shit from Hazel Crap in Mississippi. He'd say, read the book and read the black part. Just the black part, he'd say. Read that. Don't read the other stuff. Just the black. So take it home and read it. So I took it home and it says, we took this book down off the shelf. Now that assumes two things. A, you got a book, and B, you got a shelf. And we reviewed, the book says, the first 5 principles. And then it makes sort of analogy to construction. Have we used water and cement and mortar? I don't know about that stuff. But basically what it says is look over the first 5 steps. Have you done that the best you could? If so, you're entirely ready. And we are lawyers, most of us, and you know there's a great difference between being willing, being ready, and being able. I was willing to come here this morning when Don called me very early, you know, about 5:30, a little compulsive. I was willing to come here, but I wasn't ready to come here. I had to get ready to come here. I take a shower, I get some coffee in a room, and that kind of stuff. And that's what it says. This is a state of readiness, not a state of willingness. Ready. I think it's reasonable to assume we're all willing. I mean, what the hell are we doing here if we're not willing? Ready is another question. Ready depends on steps 1 through 5. And the analogy I usually use here is to gardening. It might surprise you to know someone like me from the Bronx and the pavement and the asphalt and all the rest of it. I have a genuine hobby. I am a gardener. And I developed that hobby when I was in New York, and Don used to come down and help me and watch me do things. And he's a better gardener than I am. He has that Italian gift to make things grow. And I had this garden, and it was extensive, and it was a flower garden, and it was also a vegetable garden. And in New York, around April, is the time you start going out into the garden. And the first thing you have to do there is get rid of the winter kill, and these rocks that seem to accumulate, they come from no place. And so you get the rocks out of the way, and you work on the soil, and as the days get better and the sun is shining and the earth begins to heat up, you can actually feel it, and you get a bed, and you get it ready. Now, Florida is altogether different. Florida, you can throw this cup into the ground and it'll grow flowers. Florida is a natural greenhouse, and we have all sun all the time, sun and all the time humidity. So when I moved to Florida, it was just, and now I'm in the orchid raising business. I raise orchids in Florida because it's a natural habitat for orchids. They're gorgeous things, and they're easy, low maintenance. I have the usual other gardens and flowers, but it's no challenge whatever in Florida. Everything just sort of grows. You can't kill it. You go out there and smack it around. But in New York, I would get it ready. And then depending on how organic I was on a given year, I'd either throw some defoliating pesticides on it, or I'd throw on some organic materials. And then I'd bring out my seedlings or go from seed. When it was warm enough, and I'd put all the stuff in place, and then I'd step back, and God does all the rest. He sends the sunlight, He sends the moisture, and I would just add it from time to time. I was on an AA trip, one of those trips I'd taken, I was in some place in Tennessee, and I got a pair of these farmer's overalls. I was quite a figure. I was out there in my overalls, and I'd patrol around with a hoe. If I saw something growing there that I didn't like or didn't plant, I'd kill it. And take a whack at it and get the weeds out of it. And then in the fall of the year, September, October, the end of September, October, harvest time, I would collect my crop, usually tomatoes and stuff like that. And I'd go up to our group with a bag full of tomatoes. And if I liked you, I gave you one of my tomatoes. And I had gotten to be sort of an assistant guru up there, you know. And I'd say, you're doing great. Here, have a tomato. They say, oh, the guru gave me this tomato. And I made sure that you understood that that was my tomato. And I grew that in my garden. And that's my tomato. And I'm giving you my tomato. And that's not true at all. I didn't grow the tomato. What I did was get it ready. God grew the tomato. Nothing to do with me. Nothing whatever to do with me. And that's what this is. When we are in a state of readiness, then the Spirit of God comes to us. And we grow. We grow. According to our natures, we grow. And all they tell us to do is to ask Him. Because that's what the seventh step is about. I will spare you my lecture on humility. First of all, there aren't enough people here for me to give that. And secondly, I'm really not competent to give it. But some people, when they get to the seventh step, I have to sit there and endure a lecture on humility. And the seventh step is not about humility at all. Just look at the English language. Look at the words. It says, we humbly asked
him to remove our defects of character. Could have been written another way. They could have written it differently, that we could construe it differently. They could have written, we became humble. Or we practice humility. Or we came to be as humble as we could, or something like that. All I did was tell us what they did. And what they did, the verb here, as we all know, is ask. And humbly, being an adverb, describes how to ask. They humbly asked the God of their understanding, my understanding, our Father, to remove their character defects. Humbly, please, is good enough for me. It's a nice idea, you know. Imagine one of your kids came up and said, I demand, sir, that you give me a bicycle. Get the hell out of here. I demand, sir, you know, that's not the way it works. They come up and say, please, Daddy dear, all my friends have bicycles. I'd like to have a bicycle. You know, that kind of stuff. And the book goes on to give us a prayer. And the seventh step is by its terms a prayer. It has nothing to do with humility. Now, don't misunderstand me. Humility is a wonderful, wonderful virtue. It is a cardinal virtue. I've been to meetings where some of these dummies, they come in and they have written out the dictionary definition of humility. You want a definition of humility? I'll give you one. It's right in front of you. Admit you're powerless over alcohol. You can't even manage your own life. Is that humble or what? Believe that only a power greater than your own can help you. That you're no help to yourself. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a self-help program. Don't let anybody sell you that crap. I heard some jerk on television the other night. The greatest self-help program in the world is Alcoholics Anonymous. You feel like getting by the throat, you moron. Self-help my ass. We start off, we're powerless. We can't help ourselves. Our help, if any, comes from a power greater than our own. Admit that. That's humble enough. Then make a decision. Somebody here in the room last night said it. Make a decision that your own life is none of your business. How's that for being humble? If that's not enough, then write down every dirty, disgusting thing you ever did and go show it to somebody. You want to be humble? That's about 10 pounds of humble in a 5-pound bag, I'll tell you. That's the only definition of humility we need. But this step is not about that. This step is prayer. And you open up the book and it says, it's a prayer. It says, when we're ready, we say something like this. And it says, my creator, I better read it so I don't get it wrong. I am now willing. Over here. Here it is. My creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. This, we have then completed step 7. That's it. You say that prayer. And I think it's a daily thing. I say it every day. I say it in different ways. The words, of course, are very optional. Well, that prayer interested me when I first saw it. I found it, in view of my background, I found it a very interesting prayer. I had the impression, maybe I was wrong, maybe I heard this wrong, but I think I heard it all the time going through the schools that I went to. I think I heard it from earliest times. And what I heard was this idea expressed in different words. The idea was God loves good little boys. I remember sister would tell us that all the time. I'm sure that's true. God loves good little boys. Trouble was, I was not a good little boy. I was a little pain in the ass. And I was a very bad teenager and a sort of a crappy adult. So I was sort of left out of that proposition. Yeah. And God, I'm sure he loved little boy. He loved that little son of a bitch over there with the clean shirt and he had pencils and pens. I used to banged the shit out of him at recess, you know. Just hated him, you know, a rotten little bastard with the homework and a little book, you know. God loved him, but, you know, I got thrown out of high school 6 times. So I knew he wasn't on my side. It was a Catholic high school. So if they were throwing me out, I figured God didn't care much of a shit about me either. But this prayer is different. It says, take all of me, the good and the bad. God maybe likes good, bad little boys, too. See, that bad, that stuff that I found out about 4 or 5, I knew about it long, you know, stuff I wrote about 4 or 5, that stuff is valuable stuff. That's, you know, I hear people say, take out the garbage. That's not right. That's not garbage. That's not garbage. That's valuable. Later on in the book, it says, our past is our greatest asset in dealing with newcomers. That's not garbage. It's gold. Some guy walks in here with us, and he's new, and he says, yeah, you don't understand. I'm in trouble. Yeah? Well, I mean, I stole a little money. Oh, no kidding. Well, you sit over there with the rest of those thieves. They're all over there. All the escrow breakers are in that corner over there. Well, you know, I'm in trouble with the law. Oh, yeah? Is it felony or misdemeanor? Is it felony? That's that corner over there. The misdemeanors are over here. You know? Well, I'm broke. Oh, well, everybody stand up. And that's because we've experienced that, correct? This is not the goddamn Ladies Aid Society. This is Alcoholics Anonymous here. We're all defective. And we can welcome him. Come on in. Be with us. Nothing. I mean, I've heard, I don't know how many first steps. The only thing I haven't heard so far is cannibalism. Yeah. We got all kinds of other shit in here. But where we fix up, you know, the system, and, you know, the program is such, the power is so enormous, that self-cleaning oven is just making gold out of shit. That's what it amounts to. And that's a great thought, you know. Take it all. Take the good and the bad. Use me. See, the point of the prayer is not that we go to heaven or that we be forgiven or any of that crap that I learned about. It's simply that we be useful. So I may be of use, it says to you and to my fellows. Be a useful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. A useful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so in my own life, sometimes I say this prayer in different ways. I say, Lord, please, please, help me to be a good member of AA today. How's that? Hey, good enough? I tell them I would like to be just a good member of AA today. That's enough. And that encompasses all of this other stuff. The seventh step is pure prayer. Be nice if it went on, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be nice if the seventh step went on and said we asked him to remove our character defects, and he did. That would be nice. Doesn't say that. Doesn't say it at all. Now, maybe it does. I still have every character defect I ever had. It just doesn't, they just don't push me around anymore. You know, my lust doesn't move me to the mode of tearing around anymore, chasing people. My greed does not impel me to steal. My jealousy, my envy does not compel me to injure you, which was automatic when I drank. It's automatic. If any of my character defects popped up, I would exercise them right away. That's what they were there for. Is that your money? Yeah, give me that. But now, you know, see, with us, it's the defects of character that move us into action. Get you into trouble. I have lots of stuff, you know, back then, and I have things I like, and they don't move me around. You know, I like classical music. I really like classical music. I listen to it all the time. And the radio over in the hotel room I am right now. I've got the classical station from Portland 24 hours a day, and it's playing. It's very nice. If you call me up and say, listen, Ray, I have a CD over here. It's a Mozart. It just came out. Why don't you come over and listen to it? I say, all right. If I have nothing else to do, I'd say to myself, let me see. Well, there's a ball game, and maybe I'll go here, and I got to see this guy. And I'd say to you, well, Charlie, you go ahead and play it. If I get there, I get there, and I'd like to hear it. And I'll hear it someday. But you call me up and say, listen, I want you to come over here and bang my rich cousin. Boom. Here I am, you know. Right into action. Nothing, you know. But now, I have these defects in my, of course, age has a great deal to do with part of it. But, you know, we have a way here. And this sponsor of mine, I would do something that you're not supposed to do. I would show up, for instance, I would show up with him. He was a lawyer, as I tell you. We'd have lunch a lot. And I'd come out of a courtroom, and I'd go to lunch with him, and I'd tell him how slick I was, you know. I took that judge, and I bounced that stupid bastard from one end of the room to the other. What a moron. And I'd tell him, and the other lawyer, I'd give him a shot, and I'd, you know. And he'd be staring at me. He had this terrible, terrible stare with these big Irish blue eyes. And he'd look at me and he'd say, we don't do that. So I'd start to repeat myself. Say, I heard you. You know, he was in the same business. I know what you're talking about. We don't do that. I said, what the hell do we do? And he would say, we do the next right thing. The next right thing. What you're doing is not the right thing. We'll do the next right thing. So what should I do? He said, do the right thing. So what should I do when it's all over? Do the next right thing. So simple, huh? So what do you want me to do? He said, well, you don't like him? I said, no. Well, pray for him. He said, I don't want to pray for him. Huh? Too bad. But if you want to help with this idea you don't like him, you better pray for him. He had all this info. I don't know who told him these things. But I listened to him. Because I really did want what he had. And I think I probably was willing to go to any lengths. And, you know, the lengths I've been asked to go to are nothing. You know what I mean? Nothing. Nothing has ever been asked of me that's difficult around here. There are no mountains to climb. We're not climbing mountains. We're just following a path. There's no big, you know, we're not down the Alps, so we have to go over. I had to unlearn a million times more than I ever had to learn. Because I had old ideas on everything. And my mind was just old ideas, full of old ideas. Ideas that I, my own efforts, could accomplish something. Wasn't true. Wasn't true at all. Something meaningful. Something like spiritual development. Yeah? I used to ask him, what are we supposed to do? He said, develop spiritually. So, well, how do you develop spiritually? He'd say, well, why don't you go make coffee over there? I said, I don't want to make coffee. Well, then don't develop spiritually. I said, you don't understand. What I really need is a good job. Yeah, he said, that's what I'm telling you. Go make coffee. I said, well, how the hell is making coffee going to get me a good job? He said, I don't know, but I've made it for 3 years and I got a hell of a job. So I went, I made coffee. Next thing I know, I had a hell of a job. I mean, there's nothing in the book that says you're going to get a job, but that's just what happened. He said, all that other stuff, he said, see, that's the stuff that's passing through. Don't worry about that. You got a partner you don't like, tomorrow you won't be a partner. Got a wife you don't like, tomorrow she won't be your wife. Oh, ho, ho. Nobody else would have me, so I kept the original model. The seventh step is, they call it six and seven. Some people do the old-timer step because it becomes more valuable to me every day I'm in here. And I close it, this discussion of steps four, five, six, seven, because there's a prayer that I like and picked it up from one of my readings. Thomas Merton, was a Trappist monk and a very prolific author. And Thomas had a prayer. And I leave you with this. He said, Lord, I thank you for everything you have given me. I thank you for everything you have taken away from me. And I thank you for everything you've left me. And I thank him for everything he's given me, the gift of life. I've asked and I thank him for what he's taken away from me. He's taken away from me the desire to drink. He's made inoperative these defects of character so that I don't have to act on them. And I thank him and I thank him for everything he's left me, which is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and each and every one of you. Thank you. Seven step, and it is a prayer, I think. And A sometimes operates subtly, and it's all interior, you know? It's all an interior thing. I haven't grown any taller since I got here. Whatever has changed in me has been an interior change. And we'd like to think that our prayers are answered. I'd like to think that. Some are and some are not. I may, maybe they all are, but they're just, I consider them answered when I get what I want. But I've come to the conclusion of late that the answer to the seven-step prayer is steps 8 and 9. So you ask, I ask, take it all. Do with me as you will. So I can be useful. That's my prayer. I want to be useful. And the answer is, all right, then do what you can to repair the relationships with others that you, I have damaged over the years. Then you will be useful to me, says my Father, and to those about you, which I take to be primarily the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, because they are, of course, the closest to me. So I came to this step as a step, and of course I still had the same sponsor, and he still was as orthodox as ever. And he kept saying, you gotta write it down, and of course I delayed writing it down because I was alcoholic and I don't like to do things. And besides that, I had a curious definition of harm. And, you know, I read the language that said make a list of all people who had harmed, came willing to make amends to them all. I had this idea of harm. Where it came from, I don't know. Like everything else, I suppose it's a product of my background. And I thought harm was, that I recognized, harm was financial and physical. And I was not very physical. So primarily I considered harm to be if I took your money. Or, even more refined, if I took your money and you caught me. That was harm. And so I made a little, you know, I just did a little thing. And I go, hey, you heard people like harm, let's see, blah, 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 blah. And I gave it to him. And he gave it right back to me. He said, it's the wrong list. Wrong list. So I pouted, you know. And I've been here more than a year. And I was used to him, and I was used to this place, and I was used to the program, and I was used to the meetings, and I was feeling good, and things, I'm not talking about spiritual development now, I'm talking about things, were happening to me. You know, the phone was ringing. I was back in a large law firm, and doing well there. A lot of money, I was making money. And the things that money brings, you know, the house was painted, the furniture was repaired, the door that I had driven into in the garage was finally fixed, that kind of stuff. Ms. O'Keefe was running around spending it as happily as she could, which is okay with me. And as it is, when I quiet down,
As I did, everybody around me quieted down, and so my seven children were... They were sullen, but they weren't mutinous. You know, they... no weapons or anything like that. They just were normal growing-up children. And I understood all this. I mean, it was happening right in front of me. It wasn't a question of faith. I didn't need faith. I still don't need faith. I have faith, but I don't need it. I have experience. It's better than faith. And so I pouted a little and thought he was, you know, being overly sticky with me. And like everything else that I had been taught to do, as I did this morning and as I did before this meeting, I prayed on. Because I had had a habit of prayer from him, something I didn't have prior to my coming here. And I asked for power to do this properly, and then I made a list of all the people I had ever harmed. See, in the beginning, I didn't want to do that, you know? Maybe it's law school. I don't know if other people worry about words the way we do. I said, then what do you mean by all? Yeah? He said, that's not a big word. I said, well, you know how you are when you're rationalizing. How about people who are dead? He said, it doesn't say all people now living. It just says all. Yeah, but they're dead. He said, yeah, that's right. All. Everybody. I said, everybody. Yeah. Each one. Yeah, that's right. Well, how about people who moved away? He said, that's less than dead, for Christ's sake. Maybe they'll move back. And see, I was, you know, weaseling. How about the ones I'll never see again? He said, don't count on it. And, of course, the one guy I didn't put on my list, I didn't want to put on my list, I was never going to put on my list, was that son of a bitch dean of the law school who fired me, a tenured professor of law, that rotten bastard. And, of course, my sponsor was a lawyer, and he knew my background. He knew all about this stuff before I came to AA. It sort of got around in the legal community, you know. Any of you know a tenured law school professor get thrown out? Yeah. Gets around. Besides, I was such a pain in the ass and so arrogant in those days, everybody said, good, good, I'm glad he got it. Little shit. And then when he looked at my list, he said, where's the dean? And I went into one of my numbers, you know. I said, he screwed me. This guy, he did. He screwed me. I was entitled to a hearing, I was this and that, he just absolutely screwed me. He said, well, you harmed him. Whether he screwed you or not, that list is not complete without him. Jesus, you know, I really was in a snit. Like, the dean gives a shit whether he's on my list, right? Alcoholic. You know, we think poorly. So I grudgingly put him on there. Didn't deserve to be on there, son of a bitch. All right. Let me tell you what happened. And I said to him, I complained to him. I said, what is this, magic? I mean, what the hell are we talking about here? You write people's names on a piece of paper and things happen. It's magic. He said, yeah, it is. I don't believe in magic. That was like in 1966. In 1975, 9 years later, at the suggestion of a guy in AA, I took a Florida bar exam, and I passed it. And because I was a lawyer in New York City, they sent me a form. I had a list, 5 judges, 5 clients, and 5 adversaries, in order to get through the character and fitness. Out of state lawyer. Meantime, the dean of the law school, who had publicly said that I was the next dean of the law school, I forgot to tell you that, had gone on to the Circuit Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, Federal New York City. Very prestigious court, no? United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. He was a member of it. And I had to put down 5 judges in 1976, so I put down his name. Meantime, I'd been to see him, we got along, and put his name down.
on a piece of paper. Mailed it back to Florida with some other judges I knew. And I got a letter from them because I had also answered the question, have you ever been arrested? Yes. 5 arrests, no convictions. Misunderstandings. A youthful man in the service of our country. And growing up in my neighborhood where, if you didn't get arrested by the time you were 17, you were not participating. And so I got a letter from the Florida bar. And like yourself, it's a mandatory bar. I got a letter from them, and they said, come down here and be interviewed. So I flew down there. And I was interviewed by a member of the Florida bar, and I walk into his office. I'm all, you know, a little apprehensive about this. And here's a guy, in a big guy in a white shirt with red suspenders. And he says, Mr. O'Keefe? I said, here we go, you know, some mushmouth. And he says, I have a letter here from the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. It will not be necessary to interview you further. Welcome to Florida. I said, yeah, thank you so much. You know, just like when you win one in court, right out the door, somebody changed their mind. I thought to myself, son of a bitch, it is magic. It is. I write a guy's name down on a piece of paper in 76. I mean, 66. And in 75, a guy says, opens the gate and says, come on in. The velvet rope here. My name. What's that? I don't know what that is. I don't know what that is. So I finally had a list, a real list. And an odd thing happened to me. As I was writing that list, it was like something physical, a click in my head. I put down a name, and click, I'd say, I'll do something about this. I didn't know what I was going to do. And some of this stuff, I didn't think I was going to be able to do it. I don't know. But I went, click, I'll do that. I'll do this. And I find out, but there are other kinds of harm, emotional harm, which I didn't recognize. I mean, if I told you you were an asshole and you got upset, what's the matter with him? I mean, I call him and he is an asshole. What's he upset about, for Christ's sake? I told him your wife's a piece of shit, too. And look at him. Look at him over there. He's jumping up and down. What's the matter with him? Oh, you hurt his feelings. I hurt his feelings, my ass. I hurt his feelings. What's the matter? Why don't he stand up and take it like a... Yeah. The book says we are like tornadoes, right? Going through the lives of other people. That was me. If I hurt your feelings, if I insulted you or demeaned you or badmouthed you and you got upset, I'd figure you're a moron. If you ask me something, God forbid, you ask me anything. My answer, the first part of it, would be consisting in telling you how dumb you were not to know it yourself. What's the matter with you? You go to law school? You don't know the answer to this? You idiot? You moron? I'll tell you. You know, give me some money and I'll tell you. You see, it was the defects of character. My defects of character was such that I literally drove people away from me. You couldn't be in the same room with me. My hate was so strong. You ever meet people like that? The vibes are coming right out of them. New people, especially. God, the new guy comes in, the hatred and the anger, and it's coming right out of him. And I don't know if I'm overly sensitive or not, but get near him, boy. And that was me. And so, because of that, because of my own defects, my own pride, anger, jealousy, envy, lust, because of all of that, I had driven people away from me. I could not be a partner to my partners, because I'd steal from them. I glom checks and keep them, cash them. I needed them. I had a drink. I kill them on the expenses. Just absolutely kill them. I could not be a friend to my friends because I would use them terribly, hurt them, insult them. I could not be a father to my children. Could not be a husband to my wife. I was defective. And I could not establish any type of a relationship with anyone else, although I had had them at one time. And so the more I drank and the more my defects worked into action, the more alone I became, the more isolated I became. And the defects cause the isolation. And the isolation bring on the alcoholism. That's why I think it is true. And in the 12 and 12 on the ninth step, the eighth step, it says that defective relationships were the cause of our alcoholism and of our failure at life. Relationships caused by defects. And my defects had made everyone go away. And so at the end of my drinking, I was literally alone by myself. My best drinking was done by myself. You know, I mean, I was a very good barroom companion. If you want to stand in a bar with me and listen to it, you know, and I was just terrible. Mrs. O'Keefe, of happy and present memory, on the rare occasions that we would go out as a couple socially, Mrs. O'Keefe would say to me on the way out, "I want you to do two things for me tonight, my dear." I'd say, "What is it?" And she said, "Well, the first one is, please do not get falling down drunk." So I never do that. I know. Just don't do it. And the second thing is, somewhere, somehow, in the course of the evening, say, "I don't know." And of course, I was incapable of either request, you know. But that's how I was, and sometimes I still am, and I don't mean to be, but I am. And so I'd driven everybody away. And I was isolated, and I was alone. And one of the first things I felt when I came here, something I was talking about last night, was that sense of belonging, you know, that came to me. When I'm no longer isolated, no longer alone. And the beginning of that was this. Because I had this list. And I brought it to him the second time. And it was as complete as I could make it. I hear people talking they got ongoing lists and they're running around adding lists. And I didn't have any of that. I just made the one, and that's it. And I brought it to him. And he was very helpful, as he always was. He told me what to do. I had sort of an idea of making indirect amends. You know, like an anonymous letter with a $2 check or something. Catholic Church has a wonderful thing called the pool box. It's in the back of all the Catholic churches, and you can put money in the pool box for the poor. And oft times when I was going to confession in my youth, I would confess to some stealing or something like that, and the priest said, "Well, put money in the pool box." You know? Oh, you can get a discount too, you know. You sold $5, you put a quarter in the pool box. It was a good deal. And I haven't been to a convention in many, many years, but I remember the technique of the pool box. And I owed a lot of money to a lot of people. And I said, "John," said, "what are you going to do about, you know, you got this dough?" I said, "No, I don't have the dough." But I said, "I thought I'd throw something in the pool box." You know, you give him that shit-eating grin like you're running one by him. He said...